We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
From WILL, Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. On the program today, Computers and You. This is a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month. This month, Peter Kimball is our guest. He's with the Fast 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for Peter Kimball. Join us with a telephone call or by email. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And again, the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. It's good to see you again, Peter. How are you?
Oh, I'm just fine. It's good to be back.
Okay. We've got a couple of calls already.
Great.
So our listeners are lining up already, and we're going to take our first call this morning from someone in St. Joe on line one. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have some questions regarding floppy disk and desktop hard drive.
All right.
My first question, do floppy disk have a life expectancy? And if so, how long do they generally last before they deteriorate?
Oh, that's a good question. Much depends upon how they're stored. I presume you're referring to just the semi-flexible, semi-rigid 3.5-inch standard diskettes.
Yes, and I store them each in an envelope, and then I keep those envelopes in a closed desk drawer when I'm not using them.
Well, that's certainly going to help. Temperature and humidity are two things that, in the extreme, can cause damage to the magnetic substrate on those. I haven't seen recently any particular figures. Gradually, a magnetic charge will decrease. Some diskettes are still readable after 10 or 15 years, but you can't really count on it. You would probably be better served if this were archival data that you really wanted to keep, to transfer it to optical media, such as a CD-ROM or a DVD, a read-write CD or a DVD.
Okay.
The other problem is, though you can still get external hard drive, external diskette drives for reading diskettes, there are almost no machines being made now that have them built in, and eventually that format is going to be obsolete. So it won't do you much good to have diskettes that are intact but no way of reading them in 15 or 20 years.
Okay. So, life expectancy may be 10 or 15 years.
It may well be. If they are stored well and assuming that they were properly recorded, that the device that recorded the information on them was up to spec and up to standard.
Okay. And you mentioned the floppy disk drive. What's your opinion of installing a floppy disk drive on a new computer versus transferring information on a floppy to a DVD?
Well, it really depends on how often you need to access the data. Is it going to be archival or not? Generally, what I still have occasionally some diskettes that come to me, and basically the best solution that I've found is not to get a new computer with a diskette drive built into it, but you can get for very little money, $20 or $25 or less, an external diskette drive that just plugs into a USB port on just about any machine and just acts as a very low capacity, like a thumb drive or anything else, except it's actually reading diskettes.
Okay, that's neat. External drive, that's cool. And then when you, like on my Windows 7, if I already do something like that, how would I access that information? Would my Windows 7 recognize that?
Yes. When you plug in the external diskette drive, and I do the same thing, like when you plug in any new device, such as a USB cable from a digital camera, it will say, now installing device. It will recognize it as a disk-type device, and then it's just like your hard drives. It'll be there in Windows Explorer. You can just transfer and drag and double-click on things as you could anything that's on the hard drive.
Okay, great. And then is it possible to use, like, the external desktop hard drive and on a Windows 98 operating system to save a floppy disk?
I'm not entirely sure what your question is.
Okay. I have a thing that's called a desktop hard drive. It's a little box like you plug into the USB port.
Oh, sure.
And so I was wondering if, now I know my Windows 98 operating system has USB ports on the back of it, and I was wondering if I could just use that to save the floppy disk on.
Probably. The question would be, on an older machine such as one running Windows 98, will it have the proper drivers? Will it be able to talk appropriately to the disk drive? But it should certainly work. There's no theoretical or fundamental reason that it shouldn't work. You just may have a few issues since it is an older operating system.
Yeah, okay. Because, like you say, the life expectancy of the floppies aren't going to be that much longer, so I'm really thinking about just getting rid of them, and I'm trying to figure out the best way. And is it possible to use that external desktop hard drive to save documents in lieu of saving on DVDs?
It certainly should be. That is one common way that a lot of people do backups. Western Digital and many other companies make external hard drives. Basically, that's what they are. And they simply plug in and act as a addition to the hard drive storage that's built into the computer.
Okay, very good. Now I've proposed several things about the floppies. Now I'd like to have your recommendation of what would you recommend how to transfer that information I have on my floppies from my in my Windows 7 to Windows 7.
Again, you just need a diskette drive, which you can get easily and plug it into an external one and plug it into a USB port. And then depending on how you want to store it, if you want easy access to it, put it on a hard drive, either internal or an external desktop hard drive. If it's just something you need to keep and only access occasionally, you would still transfer it to the Windows 7 machine, but then put a burnable CD or a DVD into your optical drive and drag to it, and Windows 7 will recognize that you want to burn those CDs or create a copy, burn the information into those CDs, and you should be all set. It's been made pretty easy to do in Windows 7 as well as in the prior version, Windows Vista.
So you're recommending using the CDs or DVDs as opposed to using that desktop hard drive?
Yes, if it's for archival purposes, that you don't need to really get to the information frequently.
Uh-huh. Okay, very good.
Okay.
Thanks, Peter.
You're quite welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Chicago on line 2. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Well, I'm troubled.
Okay.
I have what I like to call a lot of debris on my hard drive. And what it is a number of folders with very long strings of as many as 30 characters, starting out with 0DACF8B57. I won't go through the whole thing. And I'm looking at one now that contains an RTF file and a whole bunch of DLLs. I don't know how they got there, and I don't know what they are, and I don't know what to do about it. My computer is slowing down to backwards, and I think maybe this may have something to do with it.
Well, it may have. It's without a few more specific details. We don't quite know what those files, folders and files are, but my first guess would be they are the remnants of various pieces of software that you have installed. They simply, as a temporary holding point when you download or install software, created an installation folder, which it stuck on your desktop by some default setting. You can, if you want to try to find out a little bit more about them, is look at one of those DLL files. It'll be something.dll. Type it into as a search phrase into Google, and Google will say, "Oh, this is a DLL is a bit of a software program, basically." And Google can say, "Oh, this is basically a program, an executable program that's part of this, that, or the other software package." Chances are that those files themselves are not causing your computer to slow down because they're probably not being executed. They're just sitting there taking up space, and unless you are almost out of hard drive space, they shouldn't have any real effect on performance. It's programs that are running and executing and are active that can slow things down. Now, these may well be the remnants of programs that are actively running. One of the things you can do and probably should do is to check to make sure if you've got a really slowing machine that you don't have any so-called adware or spyware. And one of the programs that is frequently used is one called Super Anti-Spyware. Sounds like it's a little bit over the top in its name, but it's actually a free download. Well, they've got a free and a slightly paid version, but I would run that and see if you've got anything. Chances are for those folders that are on the desktop, you would be able to get rid of them without any difficulty. One way you could test that out is to create another folder on your desktop. Just call it tentative junk or something, and drag those folders that are cluttering it up into that temporary junk folder. Then if you have no problem with this computer system running that over the next few days or a week or two, then you'll know that those folders contain nothing that was in current and active use, and you could just go ahead and throw them away.
Right. I do use anti-spyware. I don't know if I'm using the finest programs available, but I'll try the Super Anti-Spyware. If you give me another moment, I would suggest that, or I believe that these files really have something to do with updates, which I'm having difficulty with as well.
Windows system, operating system updates?
Yeah, this is Windows XP Service Pack 3.
Okay.
And every time I log off, it says there are updates available, and it takes as many as 15, 20 minutes to go through the updates.
And
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and then at the end of that process, do you get a message that says updates were successfully applied or updates were not successfully applied or any kind of indication of the status?
Usually not successful.
Okay, which is why you keep getting the same sorts of messages to update each time. It keeps trying to do the same updates. I would suggest, though there are a couple of links on that message from Microsoft saying how you can find out why they're not successful, I would suggest actually just doing a Google search saying looking for a phrase such as Microsoft updates failed or clear out Microsoft updates. There may well be a setting that is a result of a prior update or a prior failed update that's preventing the new ones from being successfully applied.
Right. I don't want to be duplicative, but I have called about this in the past, and I did go to Microsoft and try the solutions that they recommended, and it still didn't work. But I appreciate the suggestions, and I'll try it again.
Well, the other thing that you can do, although this is kind of major, this is sort of the nuclear option, if you will, is depending upon how much software you have installed, you could actually reinstall, assuming you've got the original installation disks, you could if nothing else works, and if it's become untenable, then you can't come up with any other solutions, reinstalling your Windows XP, assuming you don't want to update or upgrade to a newer version, having made backup copies of everything could actually clear everything out and give you essentially a clean install. That is not a process to be undertaken lightly, but it would certainly clear out anything else that's going on.
Right. Well, I think nuclear is going to be the way to go. And thanks very much for suggestions.
Good luck.
And next we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning. I have a question regarding voice rec- recognition. And I have a blind husband who didn't used to be blind, and he uses an old Dell that still has Windows ME on it. And I have a laptop, an HP laptop, that has voice recognition, but I found that for me it's fine because I'm sighted, and I can still find all the X's and icons and everything else around the window, but he can't. And is there any kind of a voice recognition program and a computer that we could get that would help him?
I'm sure there must be. I don't have any direct knowledge of such, but I can give you a couple of resources.
Good.
First of all, it may well be unlikely that there will be anything that that would be suitable that will run on the much older and much maligned Windows ME platform.
Right.
But the other resource that I would direct you to is the its acronym is DRES. It's the Division of Rehabilitation and Educational Service,
okay.
Disability Resources and Educational Services at the University of Illinois.
Okay.
They have a major part to play in much of the accessibility initiatives for the web, and that includes certainly web accessibility for those who are blind or have severe visual impairments. And I would suggest that you contact DRES, and it's just DRES.
Mm-hmm.
It's www.disability.uiuc.edu. Mm-hmm. And they've also got a number of phone numbers that are available, and they would be the ones who could certainly give you suggestions and references for assistive and adaptive software.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Edgar County on line one. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
I heard that there was a XP was being downgraded or they weren't going to support XP with any more updates. Is that true?
Well, yes and no. What you're referring to is what Microsoft euphemistically calls end of life. The XP end of life is indeed, has been announced, but it is not for another 2 or 3 years. I believe it's 2013. Might be 2012. Now, what has happened is they've ceased support for Windows XP Service Packs 1 and Service Pack 2. But if you've been keeping up with updates and are currently running XP Service Pack 3, that and the entire XP platform is still going to be supported for another 2 or 3 years.
Okay. Well, last night I tried to, after hearing that, I went in and tried one more time to install Service Pack 3 and got my whatever happens, it shuts down. It goes into some sort of never world.
Oh, okay. So another update problem.
I didn't know. I've tried before going to Service Pack 3 and had the same results. Finally, I give up on it, and then I tried it one more time last night. And then I had to go back to restore point from earlier and went in and looked to try and find if Source Pack 3 was still sitting in there and I could uninstall it.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't find it back to the restore point, which was August 31st or something like that.
Well, I am just looking, as you were discussing that issue, at a results of a Google search. And there are all sorts of things that could be tried. I would, and you may have tried some of these, but I would suggest just in Google doing a search for XP, SP3 won't install. And you will find all kinds of, there are literally hundreds of, 2,300,000 results.
My gosh.
But the first page has several things, steps to take. Some of them are from Microsoft's site. Others say won't install because you might have put this particular patch in before. So there's all kinds of various possibilities. Now, you've indicated that your problem is that you don't even get an error message. It just sort of dies.
Well, what it does is when it it comes back up, it says must restart to take effect. Then when it does, then it opens up, giving the option to open up the safe mode, and you know that page.
Right, and if you don't choose safe mode, then it does not successfully start?
Correct.
I would, and again, there could be any number of things going on there, but I would start by doing that, checking out the first page or so of some of the options that you'll find under the XPSP3 won't install search.
Okay. If I don't do that or can't do that, I've got two more years, you say, before XP completely dies?
Yes. XP is no longer, according to the current schedule, it's, I believe, 2013, possibly 2014. I can't quite recall the date. But that's the announced end of life for XP.
I'll probably be on to the next unit by then.
Quite possibly. And depending upon your machine and how much memory it's got and its speed, et cetera, the other option may be, if your hardware will support it, simply upgrading from XP to Windows 7.
That's what I was wanting. That's my next question. I was going to say just... I could upgrade to 7.
Yes.
Call it good.
It should. Now, there is actually, if you go to the Microsoft website and like Microsoft.com/Windows, there is a Windows 7 upgrade advisor tool that you can download at no cost that can run and tell you, do you have the appropriate hardware? Do you need more memory? Do you have enough disk space? And what software do you currently have installed that might not be compatible with Windows 7 because it wasn't written appropriately in the first place? And then that information will help you decide whether Windows 7 install will be a good idea. Some of the problems it might find are easily addressed or relatively easily addressed, such as adding additional memory in many cases is a fairly inexpensive upgrade. You would probably want to have at least 2 gigabytes of RAM of the internal electronic memory. But if you do that install, since you were going from XP up to Windows 7, it would be what they call a custom install, which means it will wipe out everything. Well, it'll save it as a copy, but you'll come up with a clean Windows 7 and will need to reinstall any software that you've got and copy over your various images and documents and other things.
Okay, will it wipe out my Excel files?
It won't wipe them out. It will simply... but again, let me preface this by saying it's always good to make a backup before you do anything of this sort. So copy them to an external hard drive, or that'd be the easiest, or burn them to a CD or a DVD.
Yeah.
It won't actually wipe them out, but when you have installed Windows 7, you'll have to reinstall the Excel software.
Okay.
So the files themselves will be there, but the software won't be after you do the install, and you'll simply need to reinstall it, which can itself be sometimes a bit of a hassle if you can't locate your original install disks.
Okay. There is another option. I've got a backup computer right now in a box in the office. It's not a very expensive, but it's a e-machine.
Uh-huh.
And I was purchased, whatever. 2 months ago, I think it was, and I haven't never took it out of the box. Would that have the Windows 7 on it?
It's hard to say. It could well have. It might have. If it's just a couple of months old, it could be Windows Vista. Depends on how long it'd been sitting around at the warehouse and from whom you bought it and start it up and find out.
Okay. And then I could turn that one into my Internet machine and take the other one off the Internet and just keep my Excel files and stuff on that.
You certainly could do that. Although if the machine that you've got, that is your currently active machine, can be upgraded, Windows 7 actually runs quite well. It's a great improvement over Vista and has a number of features and capabilities that XP doesn't have, although I know a lot of people are going to be staying with XP until the bitter end.
Well, thank you very much for your help.
You're quite welcome.
You're welcome. This is Focus from Illinois Public Media. My name is Celeste Quinn. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. On the program today, we're talking about computers this month. Peter Kimball is our guest. This is a topic we take up once a month in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus on the first Thursday of the month. And this month, Peter is our guest. He's with the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's take another call now. This is a listener in McLean County on line two. Hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is about my printer. I made the mistake of getting one of those freebies that comes along when you get a computer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I paid the taxes, but the rest is a 3-in-1. And it drinks ink.
Yes, that's the razor blade model. Give the razors away free and charge for the razor blades. And
yep.
Yes, they do drink a lot of ink. Mm. No question about it.
Yeah, because the ink cartridge will say up to 200 sheets, and this does. I'm lucky if it gives me 50. It's that bad. And I've been trying to see if I can set it up. Like when I do the if I print it from the computer itself where I'm doing a document, I can go down to the lowest ink, and it's still, the difference in that is incredibly minimal from the lowest ink to the highest ink. But if I go just scanning, and it has, you know, 3-star, 1-star, 2-star in terms of ink, it seems to make absolutely no difference. Is there anywhere, any place I can set up, or I had heard this so long ago and I never wrote it down, or if I did, I lost it, about using a different font that would use less ink.
Yeah, we talked about that when the Sites crew was on last time.
Oh,
and
I missed that one, but I was I heard that a couple years ago, sorry. So if you could repeat that.
Well, that's a... It's too bad we don't have the Sites crew here at the moment, because I have intentionally avoided the free printers because even a $150 printer can have ink usage that is considerably more efficient than the free ones. The other problem is, of course, that in many of these printers, the color cartridges have all three of the colors, cyan, magenta, and yellow in one cartridge, and when one wears out, you have to throw, or
right.
runs out, you have to throw the others away, as opposed to separate cartridges.
Right.
There may well be some other fonts that that are less dense. It's not so much the font itself, of course, or the name of the font. It is how much ink is required to create the letters. So big English black letter sorts of fonts will clearly take more than some light script sort of font. But in terms of which specific ones, I'm unaware of any. Although I'm sure they're out there, and a search would probably find them.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the scanning, one of the problems with scanning is that unlike when you're printing and you have a choice to go to the low draft quality to save ink, the scanning software is pretty much under control of the printer manufacturer. I'm going to guess that this is probably an HP.
Yep.
And you can search for updates, and you can do a search for HP ink gobbling scans, but they're not really, they're designed to be cheap and not necessarily to make efficient use of ink.
So what would be, let's say if I decide to go buy, because I scan a lot, you know, just that's one of the reasons I got that is because it helps to scan things and save things or whatever, or send things out. What's a good printer to get? I mean, what's the one that uses a toner?
Well, are you scanning primarily in black and white, or do you need to scan in color?
Oh, I always do black and white. Unless I absolutely need it, I do everything in black and white. I've had to replace my black ink often, but not the colored. I just won't use it unless I don't have a choice.
Well, what I would actually suggest then is that you get an inexpensive multifunction laser printer. Hewlett-Packard makes some that are very well reviewed for only a couple $100 at most, and they're using laser toner cartridges. They are only going to be black and white, and they will last, their cost per page is down to a nickel or less. Typically, unless you're printing huge areas of black, and then simply keep your existing printer and only print using it or scan when you must have color.
Okay.
That would be my suggestion, because the laser printer will have higher quality, it will have lower cost per page, and the actual cost of the printer itself, although it's certainly not free, laser printers have come down tremendously in cost and can be had now for under a couple $100.
Okay. Now, these are the ones that use the toners, not the inkjet, right?
That is correct. They use a toner cartridge. So when you replace a toner cartridge, it's going to be $50 or $60, but we've got one that I use at home, and it's been used fairly frequently, not every day, I suppose, several hundred pages, and we're still on our first toner cartridge.
All right. That's good. The font I was talking about, what I was talking about years ago, it was probably on NPR or something, or somebody, some European guy had created one, and they say it's decent, but you just don't want to use it if you're using professional.
Well, that would be the trade-off. If it's going to use less ink, the characters are going to be less filled, and they will be less dense by definition, because they're using less ink.
Right, yeah. So basically what I've got, I can't do anything. Now, one other question, I will let you go because I know you're very popular. I have an old printer that uses those parallel cables.
Yes.
Is there something that I can do? Because that printer is actually much better, and it's still an HP.
Yes. There are adapters that you can purchase that will take a USB. Typically, most printers these days have USB input, and will convert it to the parallel or so-called Centronics output, the old parallel printer cable. Those are available if you want to spend a little bit more and want to have access to the machine, to the old printer from more than one machine. There are actually hubs or network devices that can receive signals from multiple computers and send it via the old parallel cable to an old printer.
Oh, great. I didn't think there was something available, but if there is, that would be so much better.
Yeah, that kind of connection is not built into any machines these days, but there are still available parallel printer adapters.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And we have an email question that is also about printers and printer cartridges. This is, bought some off-brand printer cartridges on eBay at a great savings. They worked fine for about a month when the HP update program suddenly proclaimed them incompatible. I complained to Hewlett-Packard to no avail. This has really put me off HP. Do you know if there's a workaround?
It would depend upon the particular printer. There may well be workarounds, but the workaround may involve moving back to an earlier version of the HP software. Again, I may sound a bit like a record repeating itself, but if you search for that particular problem, one of the questions that often comes up is it a good idea to use refilled cartridges? And basically, if the cartridge is well filled and the quality control is the same, there should be no appreciable damage to the printer. But if a cartridge is not well refilled or is using lower quality inks or toners, then it can clog more easily. It can cause other problems. And so there's really two reasons that HP is trying to do this. One, obviously, to increase sales of their own toner. The other, to head off, that's, of course, their profit motive. The other is to head off difficulties where people complain that their HP printer has stopped working when it's perhaps not HP's really their own fault. I would do a search for HP printer third party or refilled cartridges. There's most likely a way that you can move around that, but it will probably involve replacing or moving back to an earlier printer driver, the software that actually talks to the printer.
Okay. I want to thank the listener for the email, and let's take another call. This is someone waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is probably a fairly easy answer. I think I already know the answer, but I'm using Vista and primarily just for office and email, and I've got a chance to upgrade to Windows 7 for a very little amount of money through my wife's employer. Should I do it or not?
Well, I have just, after waiting for some time, upgraded a whole bunch of machines to Windows 7, and I'm very glad that I did.
Okay, that's good enough for me.
Yep, it works faster. The only difficulty you may have, and I'll just point out a couple of things, it can be fairly slow if you're doing an in-place upgrade and you've got lots of software installed, so don't plan on doing it in the morning when you've got a big deadline that afternoon.
Okay.
You may possibly, if you do what's called a custom upgrade, which means you're going to wipe out your old operating system entirely rather than just update it in place, which you can do with the same update DVD that you'll get, you may have to hunt around at the manufacturer's website for some additional drivers. But an in-place update, which means that you'll have to go, if you've got Windows Vista Home Premium, you'll have to go to Windows 7 Home Premium. If you've got Windows Vista Ultimate, you'll have to go to Windows 7 Ultimate. As long as it's the same version, it's been very straightforward for most people.
And good experience with 7?
And excellent experience once 7 is there. Okay. 7 good. Is faster and much less annoying. It's what Vista should have been.
Yeah. I've worked through all the difficulties with Vista. I don't have any problems with it now. It just seems like if I can upgrade for $10 or $15, that's like a great idea.
I would. You'll notice that 7 is faster, among other things.
Good. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
You too. And next we go to Christian County, a listener there on line 3. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have another upgrade question. I tried to upgrade an old computer to Vista since I had the program lying around. The video card doesn't work very well with Vista, only in the lowest resolution, and so I'd like to go back to XP. But I've got version 1A, and listening to your earlier commentary with another caller, I guess is it true then that if 1A is all I've got and I don't have the old installation available anymore, that there's no way to get to SP2 or SP3?
You actually should be able to get up to SP2 and then 3, because I don't think you can jump directly to 3. What they are no longer supporting for the Windows XP and the SP1 and SP2, SP, by the way, for those who are wondering why we keep saying it, is Service Pack. It's a major update and upgrade. Basically, the patches and fixes and security updates for those versions are no longer being made or distributed, but the conversion, the update from those earlier versions to SP2 and then on to SP3 are still going to be supported, to my knowledge. I would double check on that, but they do need to continue and will be continuing to support SP3, and I believe that is going to include the upgrade path from at least SP2 to 3.
Okay. And if I do this, will I be foregoing any future security upgrades, and will this machine be more at risk?
If you get to SP3, the answer is no. You won't be foregoing any further security upgrades until after its end of life in a few years.
Okay.
If you end up being stuck at SP1 or SP2, yes, some of the security patches will not go in there. Of course, no matter which version you're running, you want to make sure that you've got up-to-date and effective antivirus software, because none of the Windows software packages, SP2, 3, Windows 7, Windows Vista, have their own virus protection built in.
Okay. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign. Line 2, hi.
Howdy. Had a question. I have an iMac desktop computer. It's about a year and a half old, and I got an Airport Express. I think it's called a wireless router. Is that what you call those?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's Apple's name for it.
Okay. And my wife has a laptop that can connect to the Internet through that. It's a DOS-based machine. However, it can't seem to print. They send you some software with it. It's called Bonjour or something like that. And I've talked to both Apple techs and the Bonjour techs, and they blame it on the other person why it won't work. Do you know any problems with this or any tricks to getting her laptop, Windows-based machine, to print through that device?
So the printer is, you're printing the Windows machine, the laptop, is connecting wirelessly to the Airport Express.
That's right.
As is, and then the printer is connected also, presumably directly to the Express or to the desk, to your iMac desktop, or.
It's actually, I think it's connected to the Airport Express.
Okay, yeah. Which is a fairly typical configuration, and you may possibly need, if you can't solve this, because I am primarily a Windows user, and when the Mac guys are here the first Thursday of October, they may be able to answer this question a little bit more. Especially if Apple is telling you that it's not possible because it's a problem with Bonjour, and the Bonjour folks are saying, "Oh, it's a problem with the not in my backyard problem kind
right.
of thing."
Right.
So I'm afraid I can't give you any other advice other than trying to do some independent research and doing a search for DOS machine or Windows, not. It won't be DOS, actually, but
right.
Windows Airport Express printing problems.
Okay.
And see if you find any potential solutions there. The folks at Apple and the folks at other software companies tend to be a little bit nearsighted and only look for problems that they know are related to their own particular software
yeah.
or hardware.
Okay, I had another question about the browser and the iMac. Can't even think of the name of it right now. Their standard onboard browser is
The Safari.
The Safari, yeah.
Yes.
Sometimes when I'm on the internet and I close it, some site has opened a window behind it. So I wasn't that I'm not even aware of. I'll close the main window, and there behind it is a window advertising, who knows, whatever, one thing or another. Aren't those supposed to be blockable?
They should be. It depends on how it was actually brought up. Generally, what those windows are referred to are pop-ups,
yeah.
and there is indeed pop-up blocking available in Safari and every browser, and there is a setting, a preference that you can set to turn that on or off. And it can also be turned on or off for a specific site so that you can allow those things to pop up under certain circumstances for, like banking sites that actually need it, for example, or stock sites.
Right.
I would check into that and make sure that you haven't inadvertently enabled it for a particular site and that the pop-up blocking is indeed on in general as opposed to having been turned off.
Right.
If you've inadvertently clicked on something, it's quite possible that if you click on a link and nothing happens, it has created another window which is sitting back there behind, and that's not going to be stopped by a pop-up blocker because that was created, although it was kind of hidden and kind of sneaky, mm-hmm. by your action of clicking. So any browser will say, okay, you clicked on it, you'll get it.
Yeah, so then just close it, I guess,
right.
or check for those
yeah.
periodically. There's no indication that they're back there other than minimizing the main window. Is that right?
That's true, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right, great, thanks.
Uh-huh.
You're welcome. And we have another email question. Is there a way to get my Comcast cable internet to work on my 12-year-old Toshiba laptop? It runs Windows 98 and does not have much memory or speed. I got a USB port contraption a while back, but it doesn't work.
So, if he has, how old was that?
12.
12. Ooh. And he wants, let's see. There are a number of issues. Need to make sure that it has a reasonably up-to-date operating system. Hopefully at least Windows XP, it's been updated. There is no inherent reason it shouldn't work. The question is, how do you make that connection to the internet? He mentioned in the email, or he or she, that there was a USB connection to the 12-year-old machine. That's a little early for USB, but there were some USB ports out there. Basically, if he has Comcast service to an existing machine, he wants to serve additional machines. One assumes then that there is either a wireless router or simply a router that has multiple ports that one can plug into. And assuming that he then wants to plug this 12-year-old machine into one of those ports, he would presumably be best served by having an Ethernet adapter, basically the standard sort of cable that is used for network connections. Machines of that age certainly should support that. They may not have an Ethernet connection built into them, but there should be a way of plugging in an Ethernet card into the back of it, and then it simply becomes no USB necessary. You just run an Ethernet cable, a standard network cable from the Ethernet adapter to one of the ports on the back of the wireless or the wired router.
Okay, well,
It is doable. I've seen it done. Okay. It is doable. I'm not sure about going the USB route. It really depends on what kind of connections and ports he has available, or he or she has available on that 12-year-old machine.
Okay, very good. This is Focus. Our guest this morning in this portion of the program, Peter Kimball. We're talking about computers. This is a topic we take up here in the 11 o'clock hour of the program on the first Thursday of the month. The next program we'll do is on October 7th. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have about 6-7 minutes left in this portion of the program. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. I suppose we could take one more call, maybe. Well, since we've got a couple, we received a couple of questions by email today, let me just mention, put in a plug for the Noon Hour today, the afternoon magazine. In the Noon Hour today, I'll talk about email etiquette with one of the authors of Send, Why People Email So Badly and How to Do It Better. That will follow the weather this afternoon in the Noon Hour. That's on the afternoon magazine. Well, I had a question for you. Computing on the road, I know that there's a way to plug a cell phone into a laptop somehow or other in order to get data in the car, but I don't really know any more than that.
Well, odd that you should mention that, because we just got back from a somewhat extended trip out to the Pacific Northwest, and we're for a while staying at a location out on the Oregon coast where there was no broadband available. But cell service was available. What you're referring to is called tethering a cell phone to a laptop or any other machine, but typically it would be to a laptop, because if you have a phone, a smartphone of almost any sort, it certainly does not have to be the iPhone. It can be anything that can be used to surf the web. So you have the ability to connect to the Internet. So it's just a matter of connecting from your machine to the cell phone. There is a two-step process involved. One, the cell phone itself has to be set up properly. Most companies, Verizon, T-Mobile, and the others, will charge a additional fee for using your cell phone to transmit data from a computer. It's cheaper than getting the plug-in separate cellular card for the computer itself.
Okay.
It's typically $20 or so a month. And it often comes with a data limit, maybe 5 gigabytes of download per month, after which you start paying per megabyte fees. There are, I don't know if I should mention this or not, there are a number of YouTube videos that talk about how to use your existing cell phone if you have an unlimited data plan and just, you know, getting some unlimited data because you're already paying for it in one sense, but that's not what Verizon and T-Mobile really want you to do and AT&T and such. The other part, and it's fairly straightforward, there's nothing fancy about this, is basically at the level of your laptop, establishing a connection to the cell phone, and it can be done one of two ways, either via Bluetooth, which is the wireless communication that's used, for example, between a cell phone and a wireless headset. You can use that same communication if your laptop has Bluetooth capability built into it. And so we were able to just have the cell phone sitting next to the computer or halfway across the room and connect via Bluetooth. Or there are cables that you can get for just a few dollars that connect basically your cell phone to a USB port on the laptop. And then basically what you do is you tell the laptop computer that you are setting this up as a modem. It's like a dial-up modem in the old days, except it's really talking to your cell phone. Once you've got that set up, it's just a matter of clicking on the icon for that link. All of a sudden, your cell phone lights up and says, I'm now in data mode, and you're off and running.
Yeah.
It is not as fast as broadband, but it's faster than most dial-up modems were in the days of dial-up. And it works best if you're in an area that has so-called 3G service. That's the third-generation wireless data transfer that's most cell phone providers.
Well, I've got one more note in terms of being on the road and needing to find a hotspot. Someone that I know, her husband needed to get in touch with work for a special project or something. So they were driving around looking for, in a small town out in the middle of nowhere, looking for a spot where he could connect.
Yes.
And you know where they found it? At a campground.
Huh.
So just something to keep in mind.
That is.
So at KAO or whatever, Yogi Berra, whatever, Jellystone Park.
Yes. Yeah. And, of course, the joke is that Starbucks is ubiquitous. You can never go too far without finding one. And all of those are now wireless and are completely open for a couple of hours.
Although Starbucks is not everywhere.
No, I realize that. I just came back from the Pacific Northwest. And out there it is everywhere. My brother just was in the San Francisco area near Mountain View, which is where Google is from, and he noted that Google, as part of their community wiring, is putting wireless access points, mounting them on telephone poles. So the entire town is going to be one giant wireless hotspot, and that's the kind of direction that a lot of communities are moving towards. It's not exactly what the big broadband in Champaign-Urbana is going to do initially, but the infrastructure will be there for it.
Okay. Peter, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, and I guess I'll be back in November then.
November, that's right. Okay. Peter Kimball is with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, our next Computers and You program on Focus October 7th at 11 a.m.